I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. To get to the truth of the matter about government use of deepfakes, we have with us Dan Byman, CSIS Senior Fellow of our Transnational Threats Program. Dan, you have this terrific new report, which is now up on the CSIS website, csis.org, called Government Use of Deepfakes, The Questions to Ask. Why are deepfakes considered a threat to democracy, and why is it important for policymakers to get ahead of this?
So deepfakes allow individuals, governments, wide range of actors to put extremely realistic video and audio that's altered, that's fake, in front of all of us. This can be harmless. It could even be fun. But you could also imagine scenarios where someone puts out a deepfake of President Biden saying something he didn't say or otherwise distorting an election. You could also imagine it in conflict situations where words are put in the mouths of leaders that justify aggression, that have the leaders saying things like, lay down your arms when they don't do so. There's a real potential for highly dangerous, highly realistic propaganda that, for now at least, we don't seem to be ready for. I think there's a lot of vulnerability that needs to be addressed.
Who are the actors that we need to be most worried about, and who has utilized this to change the course of policy and history?
We've always seen governments use disinformation, so this is not a new tool. And if you want to go back to the Cold War, both the United States, but especially the Soviet Union, used a lot of disinformation to try to discredit their adversaries. Well, right now, the primary concern are hostile nation states. This is something that China has considerable capacity to do, but to my knowledge, we haven't seen China use deepfakes to try to sway international opinion. We have seen countries, governments in places like Turkey, we've seen this in India, who influence domestic politics, where people have put these out as a way of shaping the debate. But the big one to worry about right now is Russia, which has already used these in an attempt to change the conflict in Ukraine. There was a video they had of President Zelensky and also senior military leaders trying to have them say things they didn't say. And because these technologies are only going to get better, it's likely that Russia will use them and probably use them more in the future.
So the quality issue is really something that you're watching.
Absolutely. And if any of the listeners are interested, you'll take a look at deepfakes from 2022 and you'll see them, and they're actually pretty good, but you can kind of tell it's not right. Now look at the ones from 2024. They're much, much better. They're much, much more realistic. And this is only going to improve. If you think about something like translation software as one example, and think how it was 5 or 10 years ago, where, you know, it was in a way pretty remarkable compared with the past, but a lot of mistakes. And now it's quite good for many languages, and again, only going to improve.
What are some of the things that Russia could do to meddle in more direct U.S. affairs?
One thing we saw that Russia was doing in the 2016 election and attempting to do in other elections was to pit Americans against each other. For example, there was a fairly well-known demonstration, counter-demonstration related to Black Lives Matter, where Russia was encouraging both, trying to rile up partisanship in the United States, take American divisions, and widen them. It's easy to imagine fake videos that show things like police abuses, leaders of the Black community saying hateful things that they didn't say. It's really, in a way, up to our imagination, but there are lots of things that can inflame the situation. But there's a second and, in some ways, more insidious impact of deepfakes on elections. As people start to think that some things might be fake, they actually might think everything's fake and lots of things are fake. So one result is you just turn off. You say that, oh, okay, we have reports that this candidate is corrupt, but you know they're all corrupt, right? We have these endless reports and it just turns people off politics. Another variation is what scholars have called the liar's dividend. There is a politician who is actually credibly accused of, say, taking a bribe or doing something horrible. And that politician says, yeah, this is fake news. We know how much the internet can't be trusted. We know images can't be trusted. And since many people want to believe something one way or another, it won't take much to convince them what that political leader is saying is true.
Do you think the lure of deepfakes will prove irresistible to democratic governments like our own? And what about the United States?
My co-authors and I are all reluctant to say that democratic governments will never do that. In my view, I'll start by saying there are significant costs when democratic governments do it. Democracies depend on the healthy exchange of information. And that sounds kind of trite and kind of a truism, but it's really important for voters to be able to make informed choices. And when democracies start to poison the information well, it has big consequences for how their own voters gather information. In general, democracies should be very leery of this. But we know in the past that democracies have used propaganda, disinformation, and because these tools are so powerful, there's certainly potential for democracies to at least consider these. And part of what we wanted to do in this report was, well, go through some of the questions democracies should be asking themselves when they're considering doing this. So they're not just doing it on an ad hoc basis, but that they really have a process. And the next thing is, who should be part of that process? Who should be sitting at the table? These things, especially the latter, sound a little bureaucratic and boring, but it's really important for determining whether this is going to be used, if there's a lawyer at the table, if there's someone who is focused on domestic politics, or if it's just a group of national security officials.
The report presents five scenarios in which a democratic government might be tempted to use deepfakes. Can you elaborate? I could see a democratic government using deepfakes against a domestic terror threat or an international terror threat, for instance, to try to fool them into some action where we could then arrest them.
You can imagine lots of scenarios. One, in fact, in a previous report, my colleagues and I did actually was on using this against terrorist groups, you know, trying to do what Russia tried to do to us, but do it in a counterterrorism context. Put words in the mouth of terrorists. Make it seem that terrorist is against a particular cause or is sowing divisions. Some of the scenarios we look at in this report, one is simply trying to sway a foreign election. In this case, might be an election where there's a few candidates who are particularly unsavory, and the United States or another democracy is trying to tip the balance in favor of someone who's more benign from a U.S. point of view. Another scenario, and this is, of course, you know, the most extreme from a human rights point of view, would be that there is a genocide being planned. And is there a way to use deepfakes to try to reveal information or push people in a different direction? And then you can imagine doing it the way Russia did it. An invasion is imminent, and perhaps you could use a deepfake to reveal that the foreign leader was planning to do a bunch of negative things and discredit that leader before they do an invasion. Our hope, at least, was that deepfakes would be used primarily for good causes, even in these scenarios where the objective is good. There are a lot of reasons not to use deepfakes.
Another thing is your report listed seven issues that democratic governments should consider before using deepfakes. What are some of these key considerations that they should undertake?
One, which is kind of obvious, is it going to work? Not just is it something that on balance might help, but really will the deepfake itself prove decisive? And often there are a lot of other means that are more effective than using propaganda or a deepfake. And given the cost of a deepfake in terms of the political risk, I think that's important. Another is how much of it is going to be viewed only by a small group of people. Imagine a deepfake that targets a few military officers trying to change their commands and is not going to affect the broader information ecosystem versus one that millions of people, maybe even billions, might see. As a result, really change how people view information. Another fact is traceability. Is there a chance that it's going to come back to, I'll say, the United States? And here we have to think not just of a technical question, can someone find digital fingerprints that tie to the United States, but also the reality of how U.S. agencies work, where you have a lot of leaking going on, and you can imagine a scenario, something bad is averted, and then 6 months later, an agency wants to take credit for it and leaks a story about how awesome their deepfake was. But that, in turn, creates suspicion. U.S. communications in general are really just promoting deepfakes. Well, the last thing I would say on that traceability question, you have current AI models right now that are very powerful, but they're only going to get more powerful. So it's plausible that a deepfake that is used and is not detected in 2024 might be detected in 2026. You have to think about not just can we keep it hidden now, but will this stay hidden in the future? And given the uncertainties of technology, that's something that's going to be very hard to guarantee.
Dan, you and your co-authors talked to six leaders who have expert knowledge in both AI technology and national defense. What were the biggest takeaways from these discussions?
We tried to talk to a mix of people who had expertise. Some were private, some were government, some were military. They were, in general, highly skeptical of the use of deepfakes. They felt that there were often better means and there was a lot of potential for blowback. To some degree, there was a fair amount of consensus. However, in different ways, a number of them had exceptions to their own rules. One person we talked to said, you could use deepfakes for educational purposes. For example, if Putin puts out a deepfake that is doing something about Ukrainian President Zelensky and his tell is trying to make him look foolish or discredit him, you could put out 100 deepfakes of Putin and say, we're doing this for educational purposes to show people how easy it is to manipulate images, right? And, you know, you could show them in a clown suit, right? You could do things that are clearly absurd as an educational way, not as a way of actually trying to fool people. But others were, in certain narrow contexts, trying to change the orders of a military official to avoid a genocide, trying to otherwise alter things in a precise way, might be appropriate. Now, there were a lot of ifs and caveats, but they were reluctant to rule it out. And I think it's in part because these technologies are powerful and increasingly ubiquitous. So to simply say we're never going to use it is, in a way, a form of unilateral disarmament, even if we have to be careful about how to use them.
How can U.S. tech companies and government collaborate to develop regulation and policy on deepfakes?
This question of tech and government collaboration is a big one. And as we're recording this, the U.S. Supreme Court is even weighing a decision on how much the government can be really talking to tech companies on many of these issues. My ideal would be that there's a lot of dialogue. A lot of the expertise on this is actually in the tech world. If you want to know what the cutting edge is, you're often better off talking to Google than you are talking to someone in the government. In addition to that expertise, tech platforms are the ones that effectively host the deepfakes. So if it's going to happen, it's going to happen on YouTube. It's going to happen on Instagram. It's going to happen on a platform that is actually not a government platform. And thus, the U.S. government, it's doing the deepfake, is actually going against the policies of technology companies, which in general say that unlabeled artificial images that they're going to take down, right? That this is not allowed on any of the platforms. But you'd want some cooperation in some extreme scenarios. My view is that, in general, technology companies could be useful policy partners when it comes to promoting different democratic values. This is something that I'd want to see more collaboration when these companies are under pressure from dictatorships that the U.S. government is backing them up. But at the same time, the U.S. government is able to nudge them when their platforms are hosting a lot of dangerous disinformation. And my hope is that the U.S. Supreme Court will rule that the government is allowed to at least inform companies when their platforms are hosting foreign-backed disinformation. That seems pretty minimal to me. I would like to see them cooperate more going after cutting-edge problems where the tech companies have a lot of expertise and can really play an important role.
Dan, your report proposes creating a deepfakes equities commission. What is it and how would it function?
A big question is not just should the government ever use deepfakes, but who gets to decide that? And when we think about deepfakes, there are a lot of different, if you will, equities involved. You can imagine a situation where there's a military problem, and obviously you'd want representatives from the Department of Defense and the U.S. military at the table. There's a question of how adversaries will respond, which is typically an intelligence question. There are a host of legal issues. You would want the Department of Justice at the table. And you could add a number of government actors depending on the particular scenario. I would stress what makes this different. And to be honest, we kind of wrestled with this as authors, is you want someone representing the American people and the broader information environment in the United States. You'd want someone who can say, voters need a good information environment. If you're thinking of a deepfake that might threaten that, that might lead people to suspect that the information that the government sends out is false, we really have to be careful about that. And you want that voice represented in councils. The way the U.S. government works right now, we don't actually have that voice. We talked about bringing someone in from civil society who might represent that voice, but there's not a great answer to this. But you do need that perspective because a lot of the harm of the deepfake is more broadly on citizen perceptions of their government. And in some ways, that's probably more important than any immediate gain from a military operation or other information campaign.
Finally, I want to ask you, how can individuals just like you and me protect ourselves from falling victim to misinformation and deepfake content, given that there's so much of it already out there?
This is a huge problem. And, you know, many of us have clicked on the wrong link or otherwise looked at something that later on turned out to be false. With disinformation, even when it's later discovered to be false, it's often hard to get it out of our head. It's still kind of stuck in there in a primal level.
You've already gone down the rabbit hole and you're stuck.
And it shapes your subsequent impressions. So it's a huge problem. You know, one key is, of course, to try to be as discerning as possible about what we consume. And that doesn't mean only consume things that agree with you. In fact, probably the opposite. It's to be thinking out the most intelligent voices that you can for a debate, but being very careful about data quality. Increasingly, though, we're probably going to see a lot of content that's verified effectively, that's watermarked or some way of knowing it's real. So if the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal is putting something out, that they'll actually have something on it digitally that lets other computer systems know this is real, as opposed to someone really just creating a mock-up of the Wall Street Journal and having a headline saying Biden indicted or Biden resigns or whatever it is that the journal, of course, never really published. So there's going to have to be a set of systems in place in terms of how we consume media, but also within government, where right now, if my boss calls me on the phone and says, you know, hey, send me that paper right away, I'm probably going to send him that paper right away. But you can fake that voice. It's increasingly easy to have fake audio. So what happens if military commanders get a call from the senior general saying, God damn it, I told you to launch that missile. Go ahead and do it. And you're going to have orders in place that say, no, you actually need things to be validated in a technical way as well. And as anyone who's worked in a large organization know, we all rely very heavily on workarounds. Yes, there are official procedures, but there's also that phone call that says, hey, just could you get this done? And we have to be increasingly careful about that. But that's going to create a host of new problems in terms of reducing our flexibility and at times making us paranoid about genuine communications because we're worried that they're fake.
Dan, this report's done a great service to the policy community, but also I think to lay people who want to really understand the implications of this going forward. So thank you very much for coming on today and giving us a sense of what is in this report.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog